From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, state roads up north take a beating amid flood stage rainfall.
Unfortunately, we're still really in the emergency response mode. Water is still flowing heavily in those areas, and until that returns to more normal levels, we can't even do the surveys.
Also, finding faith in the land. Writer and spiritual seeker Jeff Chu talks about foundational moments along his journey.
As the church has changed, growing up gay in that environment was a real challenge, both to the Chinese side of my family as well as to the Christian.
And the story of the Pacific Club, one of the first Black-owned night spots in Kalamazoo.
They were having a ball. I mean, they had jazz players and blues singers and people in there, and they'd be dancing, and everybody was dressed up.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one Kalamazoo native tells the story of her great-uncle's much-loved nightclub and how she's carrying forward a new family industry today.
I know that when liquor license opened up here in Kalamazoo, that he was one of the very first ones to apply for it, but he was the very last one to get it.
That's coming up later this hour, but first, seven dams are still threatened by flooding at the time we're coming to you with this right now, as Michigan continues in the grip of some heavy spring rains and storm systems. There is one particular road up north that storms left crumpled and impassable, a beautiful, shady stretch of highway between Harbor Springs and Cross Village, known as the Tunnel of Trees. You may have even passed through this during vacation time. But the route suffered some damage and is closed. Joining us to talk about that and various other hazards on state roads right now is James Lake with the North Region of the Michigan Department of Transportation. James, welcome to Stateside. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk to us.
Happy to join you.
You're part of the team that monitors the northern part of the Lower Peninsula for MDOT. I just wonder, what are some major state roads that you're trying to keep an eye on during this cycle of rain? Anything in particular in the hazardous areas that you're monitoring?
Well, the one that I think has most people's attention is the dam and lock facility up in Sheboygan County. We have a bascule bridge, a drawbridge, if you will, on US 23, just downstream from this structure. So a few days ago, we made the decision to raise that bridge, close it to vehicle traffic for two primary reasons. It's not so much that we're worried about that bridge washing out, although if debris were to become caught beneath it, that could create some additional churn and erosion of the bridge's foundation. But primarily, if the dam were to give way, and we're all hoping that it doesn't, if there were pedestrians or drivers, vehicle occupants on the bridge when that were to happen, we wouldn't want to put them in harm's way. So we're doing that out of an abundance of caution.
Sure.
We have a couple of other locations, M68 up in Presque Isle County. We had a culvert blowout near the Akiak Falls, so that roadway is closed for the foreseeable future. Down in Iosco County, M65, we have a low spot that has some kind of persistent water over the roadway. Those are the main things. We have some other bridges that we're keeping an eye on due to high water in those water courses. And then also some other roads that are close to lakes and ponds where the water is high and reaching closer to the roadway. So lots of things that we're keeping eyes on right now.
What's the best place for people to find out about the evolving road conditions on state highways?
Yeah, for state highways, we have our travel information site, MyDrive, and they can find that at michigan.gov/drive. We post updates about all of those closures due to flooding incidents. That's also where we post our construction notices, where people can see our snowplows in the winter months and other information.
Let's turn now to the tree tunnel on M119, not too far from Harbor Springs. Can you tell us where exactly the down section of the road is?
Well, exactly is tough, you know, for people that may not be familiar with the side streets. But one location, which we first closed late last week, is about halfway between Harbor Springs and Goodhart. We had a situation where the slope on the side of the roadway began to give way, erode due to the heavy rains, but also a combination with melting snow. That made us concerned enough that we wanted to close the roadway just on the side of caution. Then overnight Sunday into Monday at some point, we don't have an exact time, a small culvert beneath the roadway, about halfway between Goodhart and Cross Village, the northern terminus of M119, was overwhelmed by that same water, both the rain and the snow melt. It overwhelmed the culvert, began to erode around the culvert, and eventually took out the road bed beneath the road. And before it was all done, resulted in loss of probably 50 to 100 feet of M119 completely washed down the side of the slope. So those are the two locations now that we have closed, and we have traffic detouring around on local routes.
The tunnel that people come to see is I want to say, about a 20-mile stretch of road. Do you have a sense of how much of the full route is damaged?
By these events, these are spot locations that are damaged. So not a significant portion of that 20-mile portion. So we do have, you know, some storm damage from the 2025 ice storm. It knocked a lot of the branches and limbs out of those, you know, famous trees that make up the tunnel of trees. It's still a spectacular stretch, still a spectacular drive. Right now, none of the leaves are out yet. So we're not quite to the time when the tunnel of trees is most popular.
Can anyone hazard a guess about how long the cleanup might take and what it might look like?
Well, unfortunately, we're still really in the emergency response mode. Water is still flowing heavily in those areas. And until that returns to more normal levels, we can't even do the surveys that we would need to begin the design work. So we would like to get these sections repaired and back in use as soon as possible, but we don't yet have an estimate for that timeline.
James Lake with Michigan's Department of Transportation. James, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Plastic is everywhere. To get rid of those water bottles, takeout containers, or shopping bags, you may be just tossing everything into a recycling bin. So what happens after that bin leaves the curb? Most plastic ends up in a landfill. Some of it will be made into new products. And the trickiest plastics power a Northern Michigan factory. Interlochen Public Radio's Climate Solutions reporter Vivian Law reports today on how plastic gets recycled, or not, around the region.
At a Traverse City parking lot, resident Hunter Schlies throws a month's worth of stuff, plastic bags, cups, cardboard packaging, into a bright green recycling drop-off bin.
I don't have a recycling thing at my apartment complex, so it's easier just to bring it here instead of anywhere else, or throw it away and have it end up in a landfill. Hopefully it gets used for something else.
Plastic around here does get used for something else, according to recyclers in Northwest Michigan. But it depends on the type and how clean it is. And ultimately, only a fraction of the estimated 17,000 tons of plastic collected each year in Grand Traverse, Benzie, and Leelanau counties is recycled. Your water bottles, laundry detergent containers, milk jugs often go downstate to Dundee, where the company CleanTech breaks them down into plastic pellets. That gets sold back to manufacturers who produce new plastic bottles, a win for the environment. Those are the easiest plastics to recycle, according to the largest recycler in the region, Green for Life, or GFL. That's because we use a lot of them and demand is high. Other types of plastics are taking a different journey. Some are heading to a local cement plant, where they're burned as fuel. Plastics like thin films, takeout containers, or toys. Material for which there's not a lot of demand. So GFL shreds those plastics to send to St. Mary Cement in Charlevoix to power their high-temperature kilns. A St. Mary spokesperson says plastic can replace the coal they typically use. Burning plastic emits less greenhouse gases than this dirty fossil fuel, and it means less plastic will end up in landfills. But some experts are skeptical about that trade-off.
The problem I have with burning plastics is that we already burned a lot of energy and generated a lot of emissions to make that plastic, and then we're just going to burn it.
That's plastic expert Ann McNeil, a professor at the University of Michigan.
You know, we used it once, maybe for 15 minutes to take something from the grocery store home, and then we're going to burn it and generate even more emissions.
All plastics are made from fossil fuels. So, she says, burning this material still releases greenhouse gases and contributes to climate change. And this process doesn't count as recycling under Michigan law. Still, some see plastic to fuel as the lesser evil compared to ending up in a landfill. When plastic breaks down there, it can leak dangerous chemicals into soil and groundwater. Andy Gale runs the nonprofit Bay Area Recycling for Community in Traverse City.
There isn't much of a market for a lot of these things because you can't get enough of it densified, transported. So that's why things like waste energy is a good end use.
Gale still collects what he can, gathering thin plastic packaging and shrink wrap from boats.
An example. We'll keep things sorted out. This is stretch wrap that comes off of...
GFL would send this material to St. Mary's. Gale instead sends this plastic to a company called Trex that turns it into backyard decking and furniture. Plastic bags brought to grocery store drop-offs like at Meijer or Family Fair also go to Trex. Back at the Traverse City Recycling Drop-Off, recycling specialist Matt Flechter with Michigan's Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy scans the ground for stray recyclables he can toss into the green bins.
Whenever I show up at a drop-off, I help out.
Flechter's job is to close the loop between businesses using plastic and the ones processing and sorting it across the state. He says recycling is a choice about the future.
Do you want to keep that material circulating in the economy right now, turning into new park benches or plastic bags or glass bottles? Or do you want to leave that for some future generation to clean up?
But ultimately, Flechter says choosing to use less plastic when you can will have the greatest impact on our climate and environment. I'm Vivian Law.
It's time to pause for just a moment. After that, a few words in defense of the dirt.
A couple feet down, you start to see worms and grubs and things that are working to transform the rot. And then even deeper down, we started to see the beginnings of good soil. And that was just a magical revelation.
Jeff Chu is going to tell us about what he found working the land and how it brought him back to church. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In another era of life, West Michigan author Jeff Chu was a journalist in New York City. He used to write for Condé Nast, The New York Times, Wired Magazine, and others. But then a major career shift led him into ministry. He studied at Princeton Theological Seminary, and while there, work on a campus farm kick-started a journey into community, stewardship, and love of the land. These are the touchstones of Chu's memoir, Good Soil, The Education of an Accidental Farmhand. Jeff will be in Grand Rapids this Friday at Sherman Street Christian Church to talk with author James K.A. Smith about James' new book, Making Your Home in the Luminous Dark, Mysticism, Art, and the Path of Unknowing. I sat down with Jeff Chu a little over a year ago when Good Soil was first released. Let's take a listen. Jeff Chu, welcome to Stateside. It's really good to have you.
It's really good to be here, April.
So early on in the book, you reflect on food, which was with you long before your connection with the earth and the soil, and in a lot of ways served as a connection to your family and your heritage and your grandmother's influence. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about your early years and the expectations that your family had for you?
I grew up in a very traditional Chinese family. And in a Chinese family, as in so many cultures, right, food is the thing that carries stories. And the dinner table is the place where you meet. Chinese culture isn't a very demonstrative culture verbally. We don't say, I love you a lot in language, but we say it through food. And that was always the place where my grandmother created belonging. especially when she would make fried rice for me, especially when she would put Chinese sausage in the fried rice because she knew that was something I loved. So food has always been that thing that brings me to a place of home.
Yeah. There's a really lovely passage on early on in the book. I wonder if I could ask you to read for us for a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. When my grandmother said, be obedient, it wasn't some vague suggestion. I understood it as a multifaceted commandment that applied well beyond childhood. It meant working hard at whatever I did, watching over my sister, never missing a Sunday of church, telling people about Jesus, not watching movies. She was of the firm conviction that the cinema was one of the devil's prime playgrounds. Honoring my elders and being thrifty. There were some significant long-term expectations packed into her tidy little phrase. The main one, when I came of age, I would find a nice, polite Chinese girl to marry, definitely Christian and preferably Baptist, the girl for whom my grandmother had prayed. We would produce nice, polite Chinese children who carried the family name, a particularly crucial responsibility for me as the only son of a son. And then, like my parents and my aunts and uncles and my grandparents and my great aunts and great uncles, except for the few who had stopped going to church for whom we had interceded ardently, I would become a pillar of our family's church.
That's my guest, Jeff Chu, whose new book is Good Soil. The expectations of grandparents around the world may look something like that. But what your grandma was not aware of and what your parents didn't find out until much later is that you're gay. And this is such a great memoir about not fitting in one place, the way in which the natural world refuses to conform, but also the ways in which those of us who don't feel like we necessarily conform to what people expect of us work out. People may have guessed by now that your grandparents were Christians and were Baptists in Hong Kong. Do you maybe want to talk a little bit about the position that Baptists had in the community in the days when they were raising their own family?
So for our family, we became Baptists because of American missionaries. And they very wholeheartedly traveled across the Pacific Ocean because they believed they had good news to bring to my people. And my family embraced that good news. One of the downsides of that, though, was this confusion about what we could keep from our own culture and what we had to adopt of the new. When my parents and my grandparents immigrated to the U.S., they held on to their faith. My dad joined the U.S. Army, and he's probably still the most patriotic American in my family. They have grown more conservative over the years as the church has changed. And growing up gay in that environment was a real challenge, both to the Chinese side of my family as well as to the Christian. And a lot of kids who grow up in between cultures have to swim against some really hard cross currents that are difficult to navigate.
How would you describe, I guess, the qualities and the color of the faith that your grandparents and your parents followed?
My grandparents were refugees during World War II. They fled the Japanese, left Hong Kong, and went westward in China, trying to get ahead of the invading army. And what I honor about their faith is the resilience that it gave them. They had this sense that there was divine protection, that they would be okay because of the God who promised to be their shelter in times of storm. And I've actually tried my best, to varying degrees of success, to hold on to that resilience because I think that's part of my inheritance. For my mom and dad, too, I will so often hear them say things like, God is in control. Now, I'll be honest, for a gay kid who is trying to deal with a changing society and ways in which my family's culture clashes with what I see outside, God is in control doesn't always feel like a comfort. sometimes it can even feel like a threat if you don't trust that God loves you. And so that's what I've had to try to navigate as an adult.
Yeah. I think you alluded earlier to the fact that, you know, their faith involved a lot of praying for other people. And I love a lot of what they brought in terms of intention, whether or not they were truly understanding of people in their lives that they were praying for, that there's just always that kind of intention. Do you think that's something that made an impression on you, even though your faith ended up taking up some slightly different qualities?
It took me a long time to get to a point where I was able to accept their prayer from their perspective, which is with good heart and good intention, right? Because when the impact doesn't feel great, when the impact is exclusion and a lack of belonging and judgment, it's really hard to reconcile. It wasn't until I made my peace, until I became happily married, until I reshaped my own view of God, that I was able to recognize they were doing the best with what they had. They were doing the best in the framework through which they saw the world. And now I can look back at that and say, yeah, I understood their heart.
Jeff, before seminary, you were a full-time journalist, and you did a fair amount of travel writing, wrote in Condé Nast, The Times, and lived in New York for quite a long time. And it kind of, the way you describe your transition to following faith, it really sounded like a journey that you made while kicking and screaming. Can you set the scene for us about what was going on at the magazine and in journalism at the time that you decided to step away?
I was working at a business magazine in New York called Fast Company. And when I started at Fast Company, it was this scrappy underdog of a publication. And the thing about working at a publication like that is you have so much freedom because there are no expectations for success. And I got to do these amazing stories about poverty alleviation and innovators who were changing the world. I got to go to Rwanda, for instance, and interview this remarkable woman who had survived the genocide and was trying to create a future for her kids. And as the magazine grew more successful, the pressure grew greater to do what my bosses considered big stories. They wanted celebrity profiles. They wanted CEO interviews. And after a time, I realized those were not the stories that I found most compelling. And one day I thought to myself, wow, we're just putting out a luxury product that nobody actually needs. And nobody wants to feel like they're producing something that is fundamentally useless, right? And so I wanted to devote myself to writing stories that mattered. And when the idea of seminary first popped into my head, I didn't think that it would take me on a different career path. What I told myself and what I told my husband was, I want to write better stories about religion and values. And I think that was true. I still write. I'm an editor at large at Travel and Leisure. And I want to understand through my secular journalism what it is that makes people and places tick, what it is that inspires people to create good in the world. And I think that thread of hope is what is still in my work.
Yeah. At the same time, you were on the edge of this journey that was so different than the life that you'd lived before. You tell this hilarious story at kind of a different point in the book, but I just laughed out loud when I read it. You were sitting in your office, I think at Fast Company, and there was this orchid that you had acquired, and you enjoyed it, and you're just the color, and it just, gosh, it was blooming so well. And one day you reached out and touched it and realized it was fake. And I just cracked up. Were you just trying to show us how disconnected you had become from, I guess, the earth and the natural world at that point? Before seminary?
Disconnected would imply that there was a connection before. I
grew up in the suburbs and in cities. My family's from Hong Kong. I spent my childhood in the San Francisco Bay Area and in Miami. My mom grew orchids, but I never really helped her out much with them. So one day my husband sends me this potted orchid and I just kept watering it. And I guess I never noticed that the blooms stayed exactly the same for months. I just kept watering it. And I thought, wow, this thing is just really resilient. It wasn't until I touched a petal that I was so horrified to realize I'd been watering a fake plant. But that's kind of a prelude to this adventure of becoming a farmhand who has absolutely no skills. I wanted folks to know what my farming resume was, which is to say, yeah, I'm the guy who watered a plastic plant.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to my conversation with Jeff Chu. He released a book last year titled Good Soil, The Education of an Accidental Farmhand. I really got an awakening about what it means to attend Princeton Theological Seminary through reading your account of this and the time that you spent working in a Princeton program called the Farminary, which is kind of exactly what it sounds like. Can you describe what the Farminary looked like and what the intention was in starting it?
The Farminary is 21 acres of sustainable farm that doubles as what I think is the best classroom in the world. You go down this gravel road and suddenly the land opens up. There's a pond surrounded by oak and maple trees. There's one single bald cypress to the left-hand side that in the fall turns Texas Longhorns orange. And my husband went to UT, so that's really meaningful to me. And then there's a garden, and the garden has grown over the years. When I got there, it really wasn't that big. It was maybe 10 by 10. And one could imagine that the flowers and the vegetables that we grew every spring and summer were the main crop. But the thing about the Farminary that the farm director, Nate Stuckey, taught us right from the beginning was that the main thing we were trying to cultivate was good soil through composting, with the help of worms. We were trying to improve soil that over the generations had really been depleted.
There's a lot there just in terms of your learning about the farm and learning about what your own body is capable of. What do you think was most revelatory about the first couple of years?
The most revelatory thing for someone who had lived in cities and enjoyed the picturesque farmer's market was how much I loved the compost pile. My very first day at the Farminary, I was this overdressed guy who lived in Brooklyn wearing khakis and a button-down shirt and an absolutely pristine pair of hunter boots. And we get taken out to the compost pile, which has recently been the recipient of liquefying spinach and banana peels and rotting fruit and vegetables. It's disgusting. And my professor says, I want you all to dig and look for signs of life and death and resurrection. And I was actually really thankful that I was overdressed because some of my classmates were wearing shorts and flip-flops. And I saw the goo from the compost splattering their legs. And I was so thankful for my layers of protection. And we did start digging. And a couple feet down, you start to see worms and grubs and things that are working to transform the rot. And then even deeper down, we started to see the beginnings of good soil. And that was just a magical revelation that something rotten actually becomes something that can foster new life.
What some of the most magical passages in the book are parts where you write about the process of just slowing down. And as your instructor suggested, you just looked and saw evidence of life and death and renewal in the land around you. And just the pace, I felt like I could almost feel the pace of your life and the pace of your thought process changing as I read the book. Are there some ways that you try to keep that pace in your daily life today?
We are living with technology that I don't think the human body knows how to handle. For instance, notifications on our phones, this constant onslaught of headlines, many of them really painful. We don't know how to absorb all that information. One of the things that my husband and I try to do in our home in Grand Rapids, we have this big sliding glass door that looks to the west, just to sit in the evening for a couple of minutes and take in the purples and the pinks and the blues of the sunset, to be aware of the fact that that particular sunset from that particular angle we have never experienced before and we will never experience again, that precise arrangement of color and wonder. We all get to do this. The poet Maggie Smith talks about spotting a beauty emergency, letting our lives be interrupted by a flower or bird song. We all get to do these things, and we all get to choose to turn towards beauty, even when there's so much pain and grief and ugliness in the world around us.
Author and preacher Jeff Chu will be in Grand Rapids this Friday at the Sherman Street Christian Church. He'll be speaking with author James K.A. Smith about Smith's new book, Make Your Home in This Luminous Dark: Mysticism, Art, and the Path of Unknowing. It's time for us to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to get to know the descendant of one of the first known Black bar owners in Kalamazoo. Stick around. We're going to meet her. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's travel back in time for just a moment. I want you to imagine walking into a members-only nightclub in the 1950s. Men in suit jackets, ladies in the finest dresses, towers of fancy appetizers, and legendary jazz musicians like Duke Ellington playing tunes. That's exactly the vision that Council Hayes Jr. had when he created the Pacific Club, one of Kalamazoo's earliest known Black-owned bars. The Pacific Club operated from 1946 to 1971, and one of the things that made it unique was that it allowed an integrated clientele. Patrons were required to sign a commitment to respect and to unity before they could enjoy a night of drinks and dancing and great food. Doreen Gardner is continuing her great uncle Council's legacy of entrepreneurship with her own business these days, based on a family recipe. And we've invited her now to talk to us about the family traditions and what she's doing in the peanut brittle trade in Kalamazoo right now. Doreen Gardner, welcome to Stateside. It's so good to have you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Every time I get the opportunity to talk about family and the legacy that we have, it just excites me. I feel privileged to be a part of a family that has such a strong heritage.
What do you remember about your great uncle Council?
Wow. First of all, I always thought, because I was, being a kid, I always thought he was such a big, tall man. And I really don't know to this day. I think he's probably like about maybe 6'1", 6'2", which, to a kid, because I've known him since I was baby, but he just always seemed so big in stature, but not only big just in stature physically, but also mentally, also, his posture, his posture was just one of importance, integrity, I know who I am. And that's the thing that I admire most about him, is that it didn't matter what anybody else thought. It didn't matter what anybody else was thinking. I am Council Hawes, and I am somebody.
Did much filter down in terms of family stories about how he started the Pacific Club?
It was something that we just assumed, and I hate that we didn't talk more about it. But one of the things that I do know is when he was in the service in the military, he was a Marine. And that seemed to be the theme in my family. They were all Marines. And he was out on the Pacific. And when he came home from the Marines, his whole thing was, I want to start a club. Now, I don't know what it was that spurred that, but he called it the Pacific Club based on where he was in the Pacific. And he wanted it to be integrated. And I'm sure there was a lot of integration, in the Marines. And he wanted everybody to get along. He wanted everybody to be able to come to one place and enjoy life together. And so those are the things. So like he never gave any specifics. You know, most people in service do not talk about their military experience when they come home. So I don't know if anything happened that spurred it or started it, but that's how it got started. That's all we know. You know, he saved all of his money to be able to do that.
To do this one thing, yeah. Yes. Another experience that was common among veterans was experiencing integration abroad and coming back and facing all kinds of hurdles in terms of their own ambitions professionally. Mm-hmm. What kind of obstacles do you know of that he faced when he was getting the Pacific Club up and running?
Well, I know one was getting a liquor license. I know that when liquor license opened up here in Kalamazoo, that he was one of the very first ones to apply for it. Matter of fact, the rumor has it that he was the first, but he was the very last one to get it. And he actually had to file a suit in order to get a liquor license.
Gosh.
So I know that that was an obstacle. I don't really know about finances. I know that he did save his money to get it started. I know it was quite costly to even file the suit. So I don't know if whether any financial support or anything like that was an obstacle for him. I never heard any conversation about that.
Yeah. Looking at the existing photos, I've seen a couple of photos that have survived, and it looks like people were really showing out when they came and that there was very fancy flocked wallpaper. What is your sense of the mood at the Pacific Club in its heyday?
You know, being being a young person, and we would always sneak in because my grandmother was the cook, you know, so it was a brother and sister team. And so we would always sneak in through the kitchen because we weren't allowed in the Pacific Club because of our age. And so we'd just hang around doors and peek around corners. And man, they were having a ball. I mean, they had jazz players and blues singers and people in there, and they were dancing, and everybody was dressed up. You know, it's like almost like you see the old movies like Harlem Club and some of those things, and that's the way it was. I mean, the maitre d's, they had the towels around their arms, the white towels, black tuxes with the arms around their towels. The ladies were dressed in their black uniforms with the white aprons on, you know, so it was really a five-star environment, and people dressed, and they were dancing, they had fun, and it was a mixed group.
Yeah.
And it was just live.
Yeah.
It was really, really live. Yeah.
You know, some people might have been a little surprised to hear about the creed of respect that members signed.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
You know, I was looking to see if I could find the actual creed, and I know because I have all that stuff from my grandmother and I couldn't put my hands on it, but the creed was that when you come into this place, you know, you set everything else aside, you know, we are all one people, and, you know, just come in and enjoy yourself, all races, all nationalities, no trouble, no rifts, no whatever, we're going to respect everybody. So that was the whole essence of it. And so, you know, when you think about it, that shouldn't have to be anything that we should have to sign. That should be the way we should treat each other all the time, 24/7, no matter where we are. But according to the Times, that was something that he did. And people did. I mean, they never had an ounce of trouble in the club. Not one. And everybody that came in there got along.
I would like to hear more about your grandmother's artistry in the kitchen. what were some of the dishes that the Pacific Club was known for?
Oh my God. The main one was the whirlybird. And I mean, I remember eating off of the whirlybird, and it was so magnificent. You know, the three-tier trays.
Sometimes people see it at like high tea, but what kind of foods were on the whirlybird?
Oh my gosh. She had shrimp. It had frog legs. It had ribs. It had chicken. It was so good. It
Amazing.
Was so good.
Did you find over the years, were there many people who, when they found out, you know, what family you were from, that they would share memories of things that happened at the Pacific Club over time?
Yes. And I think a lot of people, even still in Kalamazoo, they like, you're related to Council Hall of Salty? Yes, that's my grandmother and my uncle, my great uncle. And so But and I yeah, because I you hear people and they'll say, oh, the Pacific Club, the Whirly Bird, the Pacific Club, the Whirly Bird. And she made these huge clubs hamburgers. Oh God, they were so good on sourdough bread. Oh my God.
Oh.
So yeah, her fried chicken was off the I was oh just magnificent. My grandmother was a notorious cook.
A notorious cook. Okay, there are good cooks and then there are
Yeah,
notorious
notorious
cooks.
cook. Yeah. They would fly her, people would fly her out to California to do parties and different things.
Oh
Yes.
my gosh.
And so one of the things that I do regret, and I say this so that anybody's listening and any young people that are listening, get your grandmother's recipes, grandma's and auntie's recipes, because a lot of them I knew and that I can do, but there's so many of them that are in the grave right now. You know, those are the kinds of things that you wish that you still had a hold of. So, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Doreen Gardner. She is part of the family of Council Hayes Jr., who was the proprietor of the Pacific Club in Kalamazoo from the 50s through the 70s. And she is also a CEO in her own right now. Let's talk about your business. You have started a peanut brittle business. How did,
Yeah.
like, was that a family treat for you?
Yes, it was a family treat. My mom, since we were little kids, probably like five or whatever, she started making peanut brittle and giving it away for holidays. My mother is also a great cook. She was more in the sweets and snacks. Yeah, I have a plethora of recipes of hers. But anyway, every holiday we all get in the kitchen and kick off, you know, the making of her peanut brittle for her to give away. And when I was about 13 years old, I remember her saying, putting the spoon in my hand and say, go stir. So that was kind of my first indoctrination to it. And then at the age of 40, she gave me the recipe card and told me to protect it. I didn't know what she was talking about at that point in time, but I did. And then even just before she passed, she gave me all of her private triple secret recipe books and told me they were for my eyes only. Right. So
Wow.
this is so this is and I didn't I don't think that she knew what she was really doing, that she wasn't just passing down recipes, but she was passing down a legacy for us to continue. But anyway, what happened in 2020, she was sick and her health was failing, and she said, you're going to take it over. And I'm like, no, I'm not. She says, yes, you are. I said, no, I am not. That is your tradition. That's what you enjoy doing. Peanut brittle is not my thing. I will not. So her and I kept butting heads. She went to my dad and told my dad on me. And my dad comes to me and looks me in the eyes, and all he said to me was, you're going to help your mom.
Oh, no pressure.
No pressure, no
No
pressure.
pressure at all there.
No pressure. E.F. Hutton spoke, and then you do what he says. So I did it, but I did it with an attitude. I was angry. I was mad, you know, the whole time. But as I was delivering it, people kept telling me that they've been telling her for years that she ought to sell it. And I knew that she had sold it to some candy stores and they sold it out of their stores, but I didn't make the connection then. So fast forward, after I told her that, she kept saying, no, I'm not going to sell it. I got up one night at 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm like, I'm going to show you. And I put a post out on Facebook. I sold over 200 pounds of brittle in 3 days. People,
Incredible.
crazy. But people had started calling my mother in August to get on her Christmas list. And she had over 200 people on her list already, right? So that's how much I had to make. So after I did that, I filled those orders. I swore to God I would never, ever in this life make another batch of peanut brittle. I'm done. Right? So fast forward, my dad is sick. He's terminally ill. And while he's there sick, he says, Doreen, he says, I want you to forgive me. Please forgive me. All I ever wanted to do was to leave a legacy, you know, and I'm sure he's thinking about his uncle, his mother, you know, et cetera.
Right,
Like,
right.
Dad, you did. You were great. Fine. He passes and we're all settled. And about 4 months after he passed, I get an invite to go into an entrepreneur training class. So I go into this class and they say, you have to have a business. I don't want a business. I just want to take the class, right? So I'm still fighting this whole thing. And so I get into the class and they say, what's your business? I just said, okay, peanut brittle. Popped off. So I started doing the research, everything, could not come up with a name. The last day of class, after 13 weeks, I'm trying to name it after my mother because it's her recipe, and I couldn't. One of the girls in class that knew my daughter had been to my mother's house when we made it, said, "Why don't Mama G, because I'm the oldest one in there, Mama G, why don't you just call it Papa's? You know, Papa was always in the kitchen with Nana." And I thought, oh my God, his legacy. And that, and everything just connected for me then. And I'll tell you, since then, this stuff has taken off like a rocket. I chase brittle now. I chase peanut brittle.
Dorian, why do you think your mom was always so reticent about having a commercial side to this thing that she was clearly doing at a commercial scale?
I know. I think my mother just, that was her personality. She was a giver, and all she ever did was give away. I mean, if they weren't calling her about her peanut brittle, they were calling her about her cakes. They were calling about her little Mexican wedding cakes. They were calling about her chocolates. So somebody was always calling my mother about her sweets.
It sounds like it probably meant a lot to her to be the kind of person who had, you know, we kind of all need something to give.
Right.
It sounds like that had a lot of meaning for her.
It did. I mean, and honestly, she was just a true giver. I mean, and she would never charge people for the cakes. She never charged anybody for the peanut brittle. Even when the stores, she had, was in two of the candy stores, she wanted to give it to them, but they insisted on paying her, you know, giving her at least for the, you know, the supplies, but she didn't really want to do that. That was just her nature. And I've kind of picked that up because what I want to do is I want to be able to use this business to be able to give back to the community that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. I'd like to be able to help one day have a factory where we're producing the peanut brittle to be able to supply jobs, you know, for marginalized and people that are traditionally overlooked. I also would like to be able to close that wealth gap, you know, and help people to, you know, make different choices with finances so that they'll be able to put a down payment on a house, put their kids through college, those kinds of things. So, yeah.
As you've gone through this journey of growing the business, are there mm-hmm. things that have helped you? I mean, from what you said from that very first batch where you were totally maxed out on orders and came away saying, "Never again, I will not make peanut brittle for sale ever again." Were there some things that have helped you as you have scaled the business to keep it something that is still doable?
You know, I think the biggest thing that I would have to say would be knowing my why. And so knowing your why am I doing this? Because I'll tell you right now, I'm 73 years old, number one. And, I started this at the age of 68. I had retired from AT&T. I was a manager, you know, for 24 years with the company, retired. I'm also a licensed and ordained minister. And so, you know, I was doing fine. I mean, I'm okay. And I had no intention at that age to be able to start up another business. But when I look back at when my dad's, you know, request as he was passing, and I look at the history of the family, it's like something that's just in me that rose up that I can't stop and I couldn't say no to. And so my why is continuing on with the legacy, that family legacy, the family tradition that probably was supposed to happen a while ago, but maybe I just wasn't ready for it. And to let people know that even at this age, sometimes we want to sit down and say that our life is, you know, done. We're just going to sit back. But hey, I'm running like a 20-year-old with this business, and I feel good. I feel good.
Good. Doreen Gardner is the CEO of Papa's Brittle. And she is also part of the Gardner family. Council Hayes, her great uncle, was the proprietor at the Pacific Club in Kalamazoo for many years and brought a lot of joy into people's lives. Doreen Gardner, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's all for Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansug, Michelle Jokish-Polo, and April Van Buren. The senior producer of Stateside is Mercedes Mejia, and our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Our interns are Molly Anderson, Astrid Code, and Maximilian Resch. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. Find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Good to have you with us today. We'll see you again tomorrow. Take care.